If you have a question about your pet's health, you are listening to the right station, because our guest today, Dr. Sandy Newberry of Madison, is a National Shelter Medicine Extension veterinarian. Larry Mueller here. We're very happy to have her with us today. And certainly, if you have a question about your pet's health, we welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Dr. Sandy Newberry, welcome back.
Thanks a lot. It's nice to be here.
How are your pet's health?
My pet's health is good today. I don't know if you remember last time Peanut had gotten into a bit of trouble, but she's all good now. She's totally fine.
Good. Even veterinarians.
Still naughty, however. I haven't fixed that problem.
Well, I tell you what, we have so many callers online. Let's just go right to the phones here and see what's on Lisa's mind in Rhinelander. Lisa, hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. My question is about the health of a dog's pads on the bottom of their feet.
Yeah.
My dog, it may be because of his gait or something, there's one side of one foot has almost claw-like protuberances coming from his pad. And I didn't notice it until recently when he was well-groomed and everything. And it may be because of his gait. I'm told he's a field spaniel, which is a cross between a water spaniel and a cocker spaniel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I have a question about is that a real breed or?
That part, I'm not as good with dog breeds as some. And so, you know, but if he's a spaniel, and it sounds like what you're talking about is some kind of a keratin growth off the pad of his foot. These are the kinds of things that are really hard to do on the radio where I can't see what you're talking about. It's something that I would definitely recommend at least running it by your veterinarian to have them just look at it and tell you for sure that it's nothing. It's not the sort of thing that would normally develop probably just because of a dog's gait, if what you're saying is really true, where it kind of is this thing that's sticking out, there can be some kind of fungal growths that can grow that way, or it really can just be keratin growths that grow that way. And sometimes they'll even kind of, you know, like we do with calluses on our feet, they can, you know, take those off, and it may make the dog more comfortable. It doesn't seem to be hurting him, though.
No, it doesn't.
No.
That's great. So it's probably just keratin and callus building up there, but it is something that sounds like it would be a good thing to kind of get checked out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Lisa. Paula in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Paula.
Good morning. How are you, folks?
Great. Thank you for calling.
See, I was calling about my 10-year-old Brittany Spaniel Willie.
Okay.
We recently built a new kennel for him, and we put bark mulch in it.
Okay.
And about 3 days after he got to go in and use his new kennel, he started getting a red eye. And then it proceeded to be that his lid began to swell, and it looked like he had like a little blood mark on it. And when you would roll up the eyelid, there would be little nodules on the inside of the eyelid. And I took him to the vet, and the vet was a touch perplexed. We put him on an antibiotic for a week, and it didn't do anything. And it has gone over to the other eye, and the poor lids are just, they're swollen up like a quarter of an inch each, and we've got them on eye drops and antibiotics, and it just doesn't seem to be getting better, and I wondered your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the time of year where allergies start in. And so it could be that he's having some kind of allergic reaction. It could be that either he's having some kind of reaction to the bark mulch that you're talking about, or it even could be just that it was coincidence that at the same time that he went out into the bark mulch, you know, that his eyes flared up just because that's the same time of the year, too. So it could be a seasonal thing.
Could it be the bark mulch?
Or it could be the bark mulch. And, I mean, one way of sort of checking that out would be to keep him away from there for a few days and see if things start to improve.
Well, we did take him because we still have his old kennel, and we did totally remove him from that and took all the bark mulch out of the big kennel. And it just doesn't seem to be getting any better. It was very windy. We live out in the country, and it has been very windy. So, you know, I could see where stuff could have blown in the eye.
Yeah, I mean, when you first started talking about it, I was thinking it sounded like he might have actually gotten something in his eye. You know, we call it a foreign body, so he might have actually gotten something in his eye or something kind of lodged up between his eye and the lid of his eye. But the fact that it went to the other eye, I mean, it is possible that he got a little bit of mulch in both eyes, but probably not.
Not that likely.
Okay.
And the
nodules
that you're seeing on the underside of his lid are probably just reaction to something. And so you kind of, it would be good to figure out what kind of reaction is going on there. And you can actually scrape the conjunctiva inside the lid and kind of look at that on a slide to sort of see what kind of cells are there that can help you figure out what kind of reaction is going on. But it's something I would definitely try to keep him away from the mulch for a few days, see if it's getting better. But if it's not getting better and it continues to get worse, that's the sort of thing I would then go in to see probably an ophthalmologist.
Absolutely. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's go to John in Madison next. John, hi to you.
I'm fine. Good morning.
Good morning. What can we do for you?
I have a golden retriever who has one of the worst cases of hip dysplasia the vet has ever seen.
Oh, goodness.
He's apparently got no sockets, just balls.
And how old is he?
He's 9 months now.
Okay.
Surgery apparently is not an option at this point. What can I do to keep him comfortable? We've got him on Tamarol, I think it is.
Okay.
Some kind of a painkiller.
Yeah.
And now I'm noticing that his right leg buckles backwards when he walks. So he's got issues there, too. Is there something we can do to help him out? Or?
Well, there's a couple different things. And there are some surgeries they can do real early on for dogs. And he's probably out of the window for those. But there are other surgeries that they call salvage procedures. But really what it is a way of making the joint, the hip joint is a ball and socket joint, like you said, and they can do surgery that will actually turn that joint into a non-articulating joint. So it would be more like the shoulder. So dog's shoulder joint, the bones don't come together in a shoulder joint. The bones sort of glide by muscle support. And so you can actually, through surgical intervention, turn the hip into a similar type of joint. And then through physical therapy and exercise, they build up the muscles around the hip that can protect their hips. And most dogs do really well with that, and it will make them pain-free. So that may be something that you want to talk with a veterinarian about if it sounds like it's as bad as it is.
Is that the one where they shave the ball flat?
They take the ball off, basically, is what they do. It's called the femoral head osteotomy.
Well, he's going for his fourth vet opinion Friday.
Yeah, and are you going to see an orthopedic surgeon?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be my recommendation.
Mm-hmm. We've been to the UW Vet School and everywhere beyond, so.
Yeah, so that's what I would recommend, and really consider doing that and then following up with a good physical therapist to really help him build up those muscles and get strong. Because otherwise, if he's like that at this age, you know, as he gets older, it's just going to become worse and more painful.
Yeah.
And you can get those dogs to be pain-free.
Oh, okay.
All right. Good luck, John.
Good luck.
All right, thank you.
By the way, do you have pet insurance? Oh, I lost him. Too bad. That could be an expensive little proposition, I would expect.
Yeah, it could be. But, you know, I mean, anytime you go for orthopedic surgery, it's going to be expensive. It's not one of the ones that's, you know, just completely outlandishly expensive because they're not putting in implants. And there's not a lot that has to heal, bony healing afterwards. So, you know, dogs do really pretty well with it.
All right. Thanks, John. Again, Colette in Hartford, it's your turn now. Hi, Colette.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two 3-year-old Siberian Huskies, and I have been, the vet and I have been kind of meeting on a semi-regular basis to try and diagnose a problem with my female. She's about 40 pounds, and she's a red and white husky.
Uh-huh.
And the vet has kind of come to the resolve that, you know, we don't know what's going on. And there was a possibility that we thought it could be a zinc deficiency.
Okay. Why don't you describe what you're seeing?
Well, she's got on her ear, just the one ear, it's just kind of a hard, kind of, it's not even like a discharge, it's just kind of hard skin.
Uh-huh.
On her skin, it's kind of flaky, and they've tested her for ringworm, and they've tested her for, you know, some other parasites or something like that. And she started to develop kind of an itchy inflammation underneath her, on her lower jaw as well.
Now, did you try supplementing with zinc?
Well, that was kind of going to be our next step. What the vet, you know, and my female has had other issues as well. So when we, she had a mast cell tumor.
Uh-huh.
Twice now, she's only 3 years old, but, you know, they said that with complete excision of these mast cell tumors, there's really no connection between that and this, and, you know, they consider her cured of those. When she went in for her last surgery, which was only about a month and a half ago, they did do a punch biopsy.
And, yeah, and what did that say?
That was kind of inconclusive.
Yeah.
So,
it sounds,
you know,
like...
She said that the zinc problems can kind of be difficult to...
To diagnose.
Yep, yeah,
they sure can be. Again, this is my morning where I'm just sending everyone to the specialist, it seems like. But really, once you get into these more complicated skin issues, it really is sometimes a good idea to go to see a dermatologist. I mean, it sounds like your vet is managing it really pretty well, and that's great. You may want to just check in for a consultation with a dermatologist. Sometimes you might even want to have, there's people who are pathologists who read biopsies, and then there are some people who are actually dermatopathologists, so there are people who just read biopsies of skin.
Okay.
And so it may be even that you'll want to have the biopsy sent to somebody else, and they may be able to get more definitive information. They may not be, and sometimes the best way of ruling out things like zinc deficiencies are to try treating with zinc.
Would you concur with my veterinarian that there would be no connection between that and the mast cell?
It really depends on what the biopsy reports came back. Mast cell tumors are a really complicated disease, basically, and when they take them off, you send them in and you get back a scored system.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a grade for the tumor, and then you trust basically what the pathologist tells you, which is either,
and they graded it as a low grade one,
and so if it's a grade one and they got complete excision, then usually
mm-hmm.
they'll say that they're unlikely to recur. But then you've also said that your dog had two, so
mm-hmm.
but again, if that's not showing up in the biopsy that was taken from the ear, then that's, you know, that's less likely, and huskies are more prone to that. So it sounds like your vet is absolutely on the right track. And so I'm not kind of sending you to a specialist saying, wow, you know, your vet's really missing it, you better go to the specialist. I'm saying more, just sometimes it gets so complicated, it's good to, you know, go check in with somebody. And the dermatologist may say exactly the same thing. They may say, you know what, your vet did a great workup. Now we need to just try a couple things and see how this dog will respond.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One other quick question. I've also heard that there's benefit to just kind of having a healthy immune system, to supplementing them with like an organic apple cider vinegar.
I've not
water.
Ever heard of giving apple cider vinegar. One thing that may really help is fish oil or any of the omega-3 fatty acids. Those are
put on their food.
Yeah, those are great. And I'm not saying, you know, I don't know about the vinegar, but I've not ever heard of that. But I would go, for any dog with skin problems, one of the first things that we like to tell people, you know, it's universally often helpful, is to go with an omega-3 fatty acid or fish oil. So good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls. Dr. Sandy Newberry, our guest of Madison, National Shelter Medicine Extension Veterinarian with the University of California Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Newberry. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for calling in, and thanks for listening in. Ann in Stoughton, we will give you a chance now. Hi, Ann. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for talking to me.
Hi, Ann.
We have lost four cats to cancer in the last 4 years, each a different kind.
Okay.
And, of course, we're desperate to not have this continue. Do you have any suggestions? I mean, we've changed water. We've not been able to find any common link.
Uh-huh. And are they older cats?
Starting the first one was, but the last one's only four.
Okay. And the kinds of cancer that you're seeing?
We started with GI lymphoma. Okay. And then the second one had a liver cancer. And then the next one had mast cell.
Okay.
And the 4-year-old has mammary cancer.
Okay. So those are all really different diseases
mm-hmm.
in cats. And it sounds like, I hate to say it, I mean, but it sounds like you're having really bad luck. There's a few things that are important to know in that, which is that mammary cancer in cats can be prevented through early spay-neuter. So, or at least largely, the risk is really largely reduced. And that's true for dogs and cats, but cat mammary cancer tends to be worse and more aggressive and more malignant, all of those things. And so if you spay cats before their first heat, their risk of developing into mammary cancer goes way, way down. So that is that's great news for lots of cats. As people who adopt cats or adult cats from shelters, often they didn't get the opportunity to do that, but, you know, at least you're giving that cat a great life. And mammary cancer isn't as common as things like, you know, GI lymphoma in cats is very, very common, and they're still really working hard to try to figure out what the underlying causes of that are. I lost, you know, my soulmate to GI lymphoma. So
we lost ours too that way.
Yeah. And mast cell tumors in cats, mast cell tumors usually are not so bad in cats as they are in dogs, but occasionally cats will wind up with sort of mast cell disease, mast cell tumors that are systemic. And
that's what this was.
Yeah, and those will cause problems. So it sounds like you're having a really bad string of luck, but that I would guess there's not things that are probably all related in all of those. I can understand clearly, you know, why you might think that they would be. But hopefully, you know, things will go better the next time.
Okay.
For you.
Good luck.
Good luck. And I'm really, that's really hard, really hard.
Thank you for calling, Anne. Appreciate it very much. We got a question from Jim I'm not sure where he's from. He's here in Wisconsin somewhere. Anyway, it's an email question.
Okay.
My parents' dog has gotten a haircut recently and in her old age has become much less active, which means her nails have gone unnoticed and are much longer than they've ever been. Looks like the living part, the quick, has grown out quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
As well, and I don't know how to get the nails trimmed back to the proper length without making them bleed. She's being taken to the vet this week, but I was hoping the guest could comment on the problem for me.
That is a pretty serious, not serious problem, common problem for sure, and something that you do want to do something about. We just had the same issue with my hound dog. I'm hoping my technician isn't listening as we speak because she had to help me solve it. And there's a couple ways you can do it, but the theory is the same, which is basically the only way to get the quick to back up is to keep trimming the nails. And so what you could do is try trimming the nails a teeny little bit, you know, every time it seems like you can trim a little bit off, then the quick will over time back up. But if the nails are really long and it's really a problem, sometimes what you need to do is either sedate the dog and then you trim them and then you use a styptic to make them stop bleeding, give the dog a little bit of pain meds, and then you're on your way. So that is what sometimes we have to do to get those quicks to back up. But usually, depending on how bad it is, you don't have to do that, and you can trim a little bit at a time. And the quicks will back up over time. So basically, however long the nails are, the quick will back up just a little bit from there. And so if you trim and then wait a week or so and watch, then the quick will back up like a little bit and then trim again. What you're talking about is really just shaving off a little bit. And it's going to take a lot longer to do it that way than it is to have the vet give some pain meds and sedation and trim them back. So it really depends on how long they are and whether they're really a problem. In shelter settings, we wind up doing that a lot where we sedate the dogs and trim them back, because sometimes we'll even get dogs and cats who get their nails that are grown into their pads.
Oh, ouch.
And so then we have to really intervene and do something about it.
And this is an older dog, so putting the dog
just
sedating,
a little sedation and all that, you know, that should be safe as long as your veterinarian, you know, clears that that's safe.
Judy in Grand Marsh, it's your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
We have a poodle, standard poodle, German short hair mix, and he was diagnosed with Lyme disease. Last year he had his Lyme vaccination, and this was diagnosed about 2 weeks after this year's Lyme vaccination. The doctor said once in a while there has been information on a bad batch, and I asked him if this would trigger his reporting this to the vaccine company, and he said not.
Now,
so I'm wondering,
is your dog sick?
He was more lethargic. He's only going on two, and he was more lethargic than we are used to when he would take walks, and his nose was running a little, and he did have a positive blood test for Lyme.
So the reason that he's having a positive blood test for Lyme is that most of the time what's run when they're running blood tests for Lyme disease is they're looking for antibodies to Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so any dog that's been vaccinated or exposed to Lyme disease is going to have a positive test for Lyme disease. And so in order, Lyme disease, because of the vaccination and because of exposure, Lyme disease can be a pretty complicated thing to diagnose, especially in this area where exposure to Lyme disease is really common. And so lots of dogs are going to have positive antibody tests for it. So normally what we do if we really want to diagnose Lyme disease is we would have to do what's called paired serum test, where what we do is we would take a serum test one day and then wait 2 weeks and then take a serum test again in 2 weeks and look for what we would look for is a fourfold change in that level of antibodies. So that's showing that the dog is actually responding to current infection if we see that fourfold change.
What is the serum? Does that mean blood?
That means blood, yeah. So if there's just, the reason I asked if your dog is sick is this is a pretty common thing that happens where animals get diagnosed with Lyme disease when really they're not really sick in the first place, but somebody does a blood test. There's a new test out that is used quite commonly when people test for heartworm that tests for Lyme disease at the same time. And so what happens is you go in to find out if your dog is heartworm positive or not and find out that the dog is Lyme disease positive. But what that means is Lyme antibody positive, not necessarily that the dog is infected with Lyme disease.
So it would be a test of the other one. You don't think he would take a 6-block walk and chase a couple golf balls and lay down in the driveway and pant.
Right. So I'm not saying that he isn't sick, but I would want to look a little bit further to be sure it was Lyme disease, knowing that you were running the test in a vaccinated dog.
Okay.
Because if you're running the test in a vaccinated dog, I can tell you before you even run the test that it's going to come out positive.
So
could
it
I
needs
have
to be
the name of that test again?
The
double
test that
serum?
I'm thinking, yeah, so you want to do paired serum antibody levels. And the test that was probably run, though I'm not certain, is probably called the 3DX, which is a SNAP test that just tests for whether the dog is antibody positive
or
not.
It had a screen that was looked at that turned blue.
There's a little blue spot, yeah.
Right.
So that just says that the dog had antibodies for Lyme disease, and any dog that's been vaccinated for Lyme disease will have that. And so we knew in advance before we even ran that test that that test would be positive. And so what we really want to do is if your dog is sick and he's not feeling good, which it sounds like he's not, we want to kind of look into and see if there's some other reason or whether really maybe the dog does have Lyme disease, because vaccination isn't perfect. And so we want to see if there's some other reason that the dog isn't feeling well. But just having a positive test like that doesn't really tell us much.
So you need to do that serum.
On the doxycycline hyclate for 2 weeks.
Right, and doxycycline would be the treatment for it.
Would it be best to complete the rest of the 2 weeks?
I would, if your veterinarian thought it was indicated, but I would talk to your veterinarian about whether, you know, rather really, we've really ruled out all the possibilities for why the dog isn't feeling well.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling.
Thanks a lot, Judy.
Appreciate it. Dan in Rice Lake, you're next. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I just have a question about my kitty. My cat has a habit of licking furniture and licking everything. Is there a reason for that?
You could ask my cat, who likes to eat the drywall.
Oh, no.
She likes to find any spot that isn't totally finished and sort of digs out a little groove. I don't know. I think that's what it means. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's mainly what I wanted to know. I just thought maybe there was a deficiency or something that was missing.
You know, in people, they call it pica. In human, you know, in animals, it's pica too. The desire to sort of eat strange substances. There's some people who have desires to eat dirt. My son is among them.
Well, he won't eat anything, but he just licks the furniture.
He likes to lick
the furniture. Any metal things, wood things, or anything to do with that.
And I think it has to do. I think it's more behavioral, though. I mean, you can't say for sure that there isn't some kind of deficiency that's making some cats like to do that. There's some cats who like to suck wool. Other cats who will, you know, nibble on your ear while you're trying to sleep. And I think it's more just kind of a surface preference that it feels good to them to lick that, or maybe there's something that tastes really good on there.
Well, I'm just glad that it's nothing serious. You know, we got him from the Humane Society, and of course, I got two older cats, and I got an older cat.
Yeah.
He's an older cat, and he came home, and he started licking on everything. The more he loved the place, the more he licked.
Yeah, that's really funny. You know, you may want to try something like getting some of the feline pheromone things. They make them that you can plug in. It may be a stress thing, and so if you have some of those, that may help a little bit.
He's the most relaxed cat I've ever seen.
Okay, great. Or, you know, you may even want to, if there's some things.
And he loves his buddies in the house. They play all the time. They're like sister and brother almost.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, and so you may even want to try, if you see him doing it and you don't want him to do it, you could try to redirect him with a toy or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks
a lot for calling. Or you can spray all your furniture legs with table legs and so forth with
a apple, bitter apple,
bitter
or something
apple
like
or something.
That.
Yeah.
But that probably wouldn't be very nice.
Chris in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I have a 3.5-year-old, well, actually, she just turned 4, Belgian sheepdog that has just recently been diagnosed with PANIS.
Okay.
And the vet says that it is a moderate case, and we're treating it now. We treated it for a week with antibiotic and Optimmune twice a day.
Okay.
And now we're continuing with the Optimmune twice a day for a couple of months.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, you know, what is that going to control it? You know, how soon is it? Could I expect her to lose her sight? I mean, you know, is there sort of a typical pattern the way this goes?
You know, I am not an expert on PANIS. I'll tell you that right from the beginning. But what the Optimmune is it's just an immune inhibitory drug, basically. And so what they're trying to do is just, it's an immune-mediated drug. And so they're trying to sort of interfere with the immune system doing what it's doing.
Uh-huh.
My best understanding, which I will tell you right at the beginning, is not perfect. And you may, again, since I'm in my punt to the specialist day here, you know, you may want to talk to an ophthalmologist because it can be a really serious disease. And, you know, if you're comfortable that your vet is managing it well, that's great. But it never hurts to check in with a specialist, and ophthalmologists would be the one you would want to talk to just to see. Optimmune is, you know, that is, you know, usually the drug of choice for suppressing immune reaction within the eye. And so probably the best thing, which is not what you want to hear, I know, is that you'll have to kind of see what the response to therapy is and sort of see how things go. And I know, I'm sure that you wish you had a crystal ball to kind of know where that was going to go.
Yeah.
But
I'm wondering about the exposure to UV light, how, you know, how serious that is. I'm trying to get her used to wearing goggles. So far, she's not thrilled about it. So, you know, I'm working to try and get her habituated to that.
And is that something that your vet recommended?
Well, she thought it was a good idea.
Okay.
I did go online and read about it, and it is exacerbated by UV light.
Yeah.
And she wants to be outside all the time.
Well, that's great. I mean, if she'll do it, that's great.
Yeah,
as long as you make sure that
they
have UV filters on them.
Yeah, they do.
Okay,
they
that's
do.
Great.
Yeah.
And again, I think you have to train them the same way you train dogs to do anything, which is through real heavy positive reinforcement and jackpotting and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And but I would think that would be a pretty hard thing to train a dog on. But at the same time, I mean, we can train them to wear gentle leaders and head collars, and people can train dogs to do all sorts of things. And so if what she really wants to do is spend a lot of time outside, and whenever she's wearing those, she gets to go outside, then you know that may be a step in the right direction for you.
Yeah, right.
I would go heavy on the cheese.
Thanks for calling,
right,
Chris.
Thanks.
Good luck.
Appreciate it. Viola in Shawano, your turn. Hi, Viola.
Hello. I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
And the comment is that a field spaniel is a very definite breed, if that lady's listening.
Thank you.
And they originate from England.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and they are recognized by the AKC.
Very good.
My question was, I give my dog, she's a Chesapeake, and she's got itchy skin. And I give her Nutrilamin rice dog food, just the bag, the kibble. And I'm wondering, can I feed her on top of that omega-3s and 6s and also some biotin?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, dogs with itchy skin, even dogs without itchy skin, I mean, they love fish oil. It's great.
Okay.
My dogs see the fish oil coming and they're, you know, they're ready to roll. And, you know, it's really good for them and it's good for their skin. And so I wouldn't hesitate to add that on top of the kibble that they're getting.
Okay. Now, and my dog loves weird things too. She loves hand lotion.
My dogs all love any kind of lotion at all. When once you put lotion on, you're a moving target for licking.
Yep. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah,
okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Nancy in Marinette. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I have a question. I have two cats, and I have a question about flea and tick collars.
Okay.
Does the whatever chemical or medication that's in there, does that get into their system?
Well, we don't usually recommend flea and tick collars. What we recommend instead is any of the spot-on products. They're much more effective, the spot-on products, and they're better. So they're better at repelling the fleas and the ticks.
Well, I did that last year, but when we put that spot-on stuff, clumps of hair came out of them.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Then we went to the flea and tick collar.
Yeah, I would stick with the spot-on product, and I would stick with something like, you know, Frontline or Revolution Advantage, something like that to use for cats, and make sure it's labeled for cats. And you shouldn't see too many problems with hair falling out unless the hair's falling out for some other reason. Occasionally, we do hear people reporting that there's like a little local hair loss at the site, but
that's what it was.
Nobody's quite sure about those, but they're so much more effective for fleas and ticks, and the chemicals in them are better for the animals in terms of exposure.
Oh, okay.
So we tend to recommend those over the flea and tick collars.
And I have another question.
Okay.
Do you have to clip cat's nails or can they fall off because our cats still have their nails?
Yeah, what most people recommend is at least checking them fairly regularly. Some cats, as long as they have good scratching posts and good opportunities for scratching, some cats will keep their nails at a good length all on their own.
Okay.
But some cats won't, and so you need to check them pretty frequently, and you can clip them just like you do, basically like a dog, but you need to be a little more careful because they're smaller, and their nails tend to curve back more towards their pads.
Yeah.
And so you need to make sure you keep the clippers away from their foot pads. And the other difference is that you need to extend their claws in order to check them, so you have to kind of push on them and have their claws extend. But most cats like to keep their claws pretty sharp, and you know, I have one cat whose nails I really never need to trim. I have another cat, he keeps his claws so sharp that we have to trim them pretty regularly, because when he just wants to sit on our laps, nobody wants him near us, and so we trim them. And so we don't trim them because they get too long for him. We trim them because they get too long and sharp for us.
Right.
If we go and get that front line and put that on them, if they, if a little hair falls out around that spot,
I wouldn't worry about that too much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Nancy. And you can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. They have some open lines now for Dr. Sandy Newberry, and love to have you on with your questions. Polly in Richland Center, you are next. Hi, Polly.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Dr. Newberry. It's Polly from the SOS Clinic.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, we miss you. I just want to put in a shameless plug for the SOS program, our low-income spay-neuter clinic we're putting on out here in conjunction with the Acouche Mountain Humane Society. We are now up past 200 spay-neuters. We feel we're making a real significant change in homeless pets out here in southwestern Wisconsin. And our next clinic is coming up Friday, May 18th, and we're always on the lookout for sharp volunteers that want to stop in and help and participate.
And just so everybody knows, the program she's talking about, SOS, stands for Shelter Outreach Services. It's a program that's through the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, and it's a program that the Dane County Humane Society got a grant from the ASPCA to start a program. What the program is about and what the Humane Society is really working towards is reducing intake into shelters, so reducing the number of homeless pets that are out in the community that need homes, so that in the end that the number coming in will better match the number going out, and that we can reduce euthanasia in the community. And what we're trying to do is also to help all the surrounding communities as well, because we know that animals come and go. We all kind of share our communities.
Thank you very much. But what's the date again? May 18th?
No, the next clinic that's coming up is going to be Friday. Friday, May 18th. And Dr. Newberry, we'd kind of like to see your face again.
As long as you can keep me in Madison. There's also going to be an SOS clinic at the Dane County Humane Society on May 11th that's sponsored just by the Humane Society. So this program is a program where the Humane Society can partner with other humane societies and other groups that are interested in just helping do spay-neuter in their communities. And the program, they'll drive up to an hour and a half, and they go with a technician and a surgeon. And when they get there, I didn't plant Polly, by the way, but when they get there, they set up and they do spay neuter in various locations. And the group that's sponsoring is in charge of sort of setting up and making sure they have a good place to do surgery and scheduling all the surgeries and having the people come in and sending the animals home. And out in Richland Center, where Polly is, they have a woman who runs a grooming shop who opened up her grooming shop.
That's my shop.
To let them, you know, that Polly lets them use her shop to do the spays and neuters, so she's helping her community by doing these low-cost surgeries.
Thanks, Polly.
Well, Larry, you're invited, too.
Okay.
Either you or Dr. Newberry or the both of you.
Okay.
We'll even treat you to lunch.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. And I suppose for more information on things, go to the Dane County Humane Society website.
They should be able to find out information there.
All right. Thanks, Polly. And I tell you what, we'll take some more calls, and you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller with Dr. Sandy Newberry here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Newberry. Sherry in Eau Claire, we will give you a chance next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Hi,
thank you for calling.
I have just a quick question I was looking for your opinion on. We have an 11-and-a-half-year-old golden retriever who has been diagnosed with cancer, and is doing quite well still. And the question, I guess, we discussed briefly with our vet, talking about low-dose antibiotics, mm-hmm. and just in order to help him while he's fending off other things in life. And I just wanted to get your quick opinion on that.
I guess I've not ever really heard of that, unless I don't know what kind of cancer he's got. Do you want to?
Well, it's into his lymph nodes now somewhat. It hasn't. It's not a rapid progressing thing, but
okay.
It started out with a growth around his rectal area, and which initially we didn't suspect as cancer, but he has now, you know, enlarged lymph nodes, and we're suspecting probably that it has progressed into, or, you know, it is cancerous. So.
Okay. So my initial inclination when I hear people talking about low-dose antibiotics is, you know, what that mostly will do is select for resistant organisms.
Okay.
And so instead of using low-dose antibiotics, what we'll often do for animals that are having problems with recurrent infections, so we don't want to use, I mean, the only thing antibiotics do, they don't make anybody feel better. They just kill bacteria.
Right.
And they only kill bacteria that are sensitive to the drug that you gave, and they only kill bacteria if they're at the dose that that bacteria is sensitive to. So if I have a bacteria and I give half the dose that that bacteria is sensitive to, all I'm likely to do in that case is to actually just make that bacteria better at resisting that antibiotic the
right.
next
okay.
time I give it to
okay.
it. Because what will happen, and what will happen is if you think about that, what you have is kind of a whole community of bacteria. And when you give the low dose of that drug, you kill off all the ones that are susceptible to that drug at a low dose.
Right.
So
and
what you did
strong.
Is you selected for all the strong ones. And that's what you don't want to do.
Right, right.
And so there may be some other reason that your vet is thinking about low-dose antibiotics, but what we tend to do instead for animals that are having recurrent infections, instead of going low-dose, you go what's called pulse dose. So you go at the recommended dose, at the dose that will kill or treat those bacteria, and you do it for a period of time, and then you stop.
Okay.
And then you do it again if you think you need to later.
Okay.
And that
okay.
way you avoid selecting for really resistant bugs, or you hope that you avoid it. You don't always
right,
avoid
right.
it.
And have you heard of that with animals with cancer doing something like that? I mean, if they're, it just seems with him that he'll have days where he's doing quite well, and then, you know, other days where you can tell that he's just, and it'll go for a few days at a time, and then it seems like he's kind of done with whatever that bout was and you know, improving and...
I guess I would want to know if I thought there was some kind of infection there that I was treating. There are some other uses for antibiotics. Some of the antibiotics will have effects on other things besides just bacteria. And so sometimes we'll use things like that. We'll use some kinds of antibiotics in other ways, but this doesn't really sound like what you're talking about.
Okay.
So, you know, I guess I would really want to try to get a sense of what it was that's making him feel bad. And whether the antibiotics are really going to make him feel better. Where his tumor is, you know, it's likely that there may be recurrent infection. So as long as that's what we're treating, then it seems like a reasonable thing to do.
Okay, okay. I just know he had Lyme's disease last fall, and when he was on the, I mean, granted, Lyme's disease was not helping either, but when he was on the antibiotics, he really tended to improve drastically. And
you know, that's really the other thing, is sometimes if there's something that really works clinically,
mm-hmm.
you know, then it's something that maybe you want to go with because
okay.
you're not trying to cure it, you know?
Right, mm-hmm. right. Well, and I know that, and I know at
yeah.
his age, it's not something to even, it's not reasonable. So to keep him comfortable until the time it comes, that's what we're looking to do. So.
Right.
Sure.
But if you were treating Lyme disease, you know, then the antibiotic that you were taking for Lyme disease or he was taking for Lyme disease probably treated the Lyme disease, and
right.
that's what made him feel better.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. For
good luck.
Yeah. Thanks, Sherry. Thanks a lot for calling. And Stevie in Springstead, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Newberry. Thank
Hi.
You very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 10-year-old male neutered Weimaraner who bloated at 3 years old. He had the surgery, survived. It was amazing.
10 years old, so that's good.
It was amazing. I got to watch the surgery, and I was just in awe of the veterinary surgeon who did the surgery on him. My question would be, since then, at that moment in time, I didn't understand what bloat meant, and I went through about 8 different veterinarians until I actually found a very great man by the name of Dr. Mulvihill at the Healing Oasis Center in Sturtevant, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. who helped me get him on a raw food diet.
Okay.
Absolutely incredible. And one of the things I would like to let people know, if you're looking at doing raw food diets with your dog, cat, or to make sure that you have a very good grass-fed, organically grown meat source, look at using all organic grains. Like I use organic brown rice and organic oatmeal with him. We also feed him some fish. My question being is, he's been on the raw food diet since he was 3.
Okay.
He's now 10. We do very frequently, have his stools and his urine, and I have him on a wellness program at his veterinary office where they run the full blood. You know, they check everything to make sure that he's online. Now, he has developed these little fatty lipomas, one on his leg, on his chest, underneath his arm. And a few months ago, he actually had to have, I'd say probably about a year ago now, he had to have 5 molars pulled.
Okay.
So I'm wondering, what I'd like to find out is, 1, your thoughts on a raw food diet, and 2, your thoughts, and I have a very good veterinarian, and she's been his veterinarian probably just about all of his life, and she, had told me that at some point in time, dogs just have bad teeth.
Yeah, so here's the deal. With the teeth, as mostly, it's just like our teeth. Dogs get tartar, they get calculus, and they get gingivitis. And we don't brush our dog's teeth every day. We do brush our own teeth every day. And if we didn't brush our own teeth every day, we would lose our molars, probably by the time somewhere around. Well, we lose them anyway by the before we're 10. So we would lose our teeth, too, because what happens is we get, you get gingivitis, you get calculus coming around the teeth. And not all dogs, different dogs have different disposition for how they deposit calculus, how the calculus builds up around their teeth, what happens with their gingiva and their teeth. And so, it's just like people. I'm really lucky and hardly have any cavities at all. And my son already had to go have, 6 cavities filled before he was 5 years old. And there's just different proclivities for that, I guess. And so that's really not abnormal. One thing that has come up in the last, fairly recently, is to really start looking at animals' oral hygiene and to start them when they're really young, getting used to having their mouth examined and their teeth cleaned, and some people even brush their dog's teeth every day.
Yeah, we brush his teeth.
Yeah,
and 3 times a week he has his teeth brushed. I have the little finger toothbrush.
Right, and so, and to go in for regular oral exams and to go in for regular dental cleanings where they do just like what they do to your teeth when you go to the dentist and get your teeth cleaned. They do the exact same thing and they polish them, and that will help animals not lose their teeth. Some dogs are still going to have problems with their teeth even with all of that. So that's just kind of normal. Lipomas are also just kind of normal, little fatty masses that develop on dogs. And one of the things we always try to encourage people to do is make sure that they get those checked out fairly frequently. And if you're on a wellness program, I'm sure your vet's checking those out. But so we don't usually want to just assume they're lipomas and that they're nothing. We always want to check them and make sure that that's really what they are. But those are really also just common as dogs get older. And in terms of the raw food diet, I think raw food diets can be great for dogs. There's definitely risks and benefits to it. And the most important thing is to be pretty careful with what you're putting into it and to understand what the risks are both for you and for your dog. And so, there's always risks of handling raw meat.
Right.
The risks are decreased if you spend some time with the meat in the freezer. Will kill a lot of pathogens. So I used to make raw food meat diet for my cat, and I always put the meat in the freezer for 6 weeks before I used it because I knew that would kill toxoplasmosis. And so, but there is always a risk of E. coli and other bacteria, when you're feeding raw meat to animals or, and you're handling it yourself. And so that's something to really be aware of. But again, obviously, I think we all probably know from recent news that there's risks with buying commercially made food as well. And so, there's not a lot of research. There's some research about what do animals really need in their diet? But we know that the, you know, that the diets that are formulated for pets are trying to hit nutritional requirements, and that there is some sense of what a balanced diet is. It's hard to know when we domesticate animals, you know, how those nutritional requirements change. And, you know, if you think about a cat and what a cat's normal prey items would be, how well do we match that in commercial diets? It's really unclear. There's a lot of fillers and grains in commercial diets. And, you know, how many cats do you know that sit down to eat cereal for breakfast if that was their choice, you know? And so maybe the raw food diets may actually match better their more natural inclinations. For cats, it's really important to be sure that taurine is added, as well as, you know, that you have a good match between phosphorus and calcium. So the commercially prepared raw food diets may be a little bit better. The home ones can be really good, as long as you're getting some really good input about what recipe to use and how to prepare them. And so you have to be careful, but I think it's pretty clear we have to be careful either way.
That's exactly right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Newberry, our guest today, National Shelter Medicine Extension Veterinarian with the University of California Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be with us till 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be right back with Sandy. Stay with us. Talking Your Pet's Health now with Dr. Sandy Newberry. Glad to have you listening in. Lots of people online, so you know what? We're not going to waste any time. We'll go right to the phones. Leon in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Leon.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, I got she's a chocolate lab and a white shepherd mix. She turned out looking like a black lab. She's about 8 years old.
Okay.
And she is... She's always wanted to dig up our flower beds, but this year it just seems like she's just terrible. We plant flowers, you know, if we give her a rawhide bone, oh, that's got to be buried.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. She finds a bone out in the field because we live in the country. She's got to bury that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and we can take her over there and show her, you know, what she did, you know, and scold her and tell her no and...
Oh, she doesn't understand that.
She doesn't understand that.
She doesn't understand that anymore. Like, when you're doing that, when you're showing her what she did, she doesn't have any sense of what you're talking about at all, most likely. So if you watch her, and what you would need to do to try to train her out of it is, first of all, I have some friends out in California who just showed me they were so happy because they had re-landscaped their yard and they wanted to show it off. And I went over to see, and they had actually put in a giant sandbox for their dog. That was what they had done to re-landscape their yard. So one of the things to know is that if you have a dog, that dogs, you know, are going to want to exhibit some of their normal behavior. And so they're going to want to do some projects, and digging is one of their projects that they're going to want to do. And so one thing you can try to do is to try to accommodate that by giving her a spot where it is okay to dig. And
it works pretty well, too.
And then what you want to do is then you need to watch her, and you have to kind of go back to, you know, lots of people talk about with puppies, what you need to do is just have them with you every single minute, because you can't teach them not to do it unless you're there when they start doing it. And so if you're there when she starts doing it, you can say to her, you know, no, I don't want you to do that. And then you can redirect her to the place where it is okay to do it.
And you can, I know Patricia McConnell will sometimes actually go to an area and dig.
And dig herself, yeah.
And put a bone in there.
One of the great things, these friends of mine who made this sandbox, what they do is they actually hide jackpots in the sandbox, you know, maybe every day, maybe a few times a week, where they hide all sorts of stuff in the sandbox so that the dogs, when they dig over there, they always find great stuff. And so that's another way of, you know, making that spot more enticing than the other spot where she is going.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. It can work.
It really can work.
Yeah. Dennis in Woodville, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Howdy.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, we lost him. Call back, will you please? That was my mistake. I did a bad thing.
Shame on you.
Dennis, call back. I'll get you right on as soon as you call back. I'm sorry. And hopefully he can get on. Jay in Marshfield. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
Well, you know, I don't have a problem with fleas or ticks anymore.
And what I did was I introduced raw vinegar into my dog's water. I use 1 teaspoon per quart of water, and I don't have that problem.
You use cider vinegar?
Yes, I do. You can use apple cider vinegar, but the raw vinegar works the best.
Well, we've been talking. I've been going online a little bit and looking at the apple cider vinegar. And it comes up as on several sites, although I can't vouch for the veracity of the sites, but several of them mention it as a way to help with a dog that has hip dysplasia, or it might help other things as well. So, you know, if it works.
Well, you know, the tick will jump on the animal. It'll be there for a little while, and I see him jump right off. And I never have a problem.
It's great that you're not having a problem with it, and I don't mean to be a wet blanket about it at all. It's great that, you know, some people, like I said, you know, if you're trying something and you feel like it really works, then that is great. One of the things as veterinarians that we get trained to do is to really carefully kind of look at the evidence behind whether something is working or not. And it's really important when it comes to fleas and ticks, because fleas and ticks can carry so many bad diseases and can be really problematic for some animals, that one thing I would kind of urge people to do is to really be sure that if they're using something that they feel like it works, to try, you know, to be as sure as you possibly can that really you're seeing good efficacy with what you're doing. The other thing that would just concern me a little bit is putting vinegar in dogs' water, that might for some dogs really cause them not to want to drink their water. And so you have to watch your dog carefully and make sure that isn't making them averse to their water, because we really want them to have an appropriate amount of water intake. Mm-hmm. So just kind of think about those things. I'm not saying that it doesn't work. I've never had real experience with it, and I haven't tried it myself, but I don't know of any kind of scientific evidence. And not everything has to have scientific evidence.
That's right.
But do be aware, because especially ticks can carry some pretty serious diseases on dogs. And so we really don't want them staying on dogs long enough to take a blood meal at all.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Jay. And now let's go back to Dennis in Woodville, who I inadvertently knocked off the air here. Dennis, hi.
Howdy.
What can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to tell you about a solution for dog's nails.
Okay.
A professional groomer may use a Dremel.
Oh, that's true.
And there's some discussion on how the nail grows and how that should be taken down. But I shared some information with my sister that I got off the net. I can't remember where that was. But she got into her manicure kit. And she pulled out one of these little electric grinders for her nails.
Yeah.
And she has a lab mix that she spends a few minutes each day.
Grinding that down?
Yeah, just taking a little bit, keeping it going back down to just where the quick is, and those nails are in real good shape.
Absolutely. So that is actually a great idea. See, now we should have asked Polly when she called, because she's a dog groomer.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you can also use something like that. Most people don't have something like that handy. The other thing is that some dogs are going to really be nervous by that kind of grinding thing, but it is good. It won't cut the quick, so you won't do that. The one thing to be, you know, cognizant of as you're doing that is that if you do grind it down to where the quick is, it's still going to bleed. So you can't. It's a great tool, though, for getting the quick to back up. Like you said, if you kind of go at it every day or every couple of days while that's growing out. Thanks so much. That is really a good advice.
And Jim Packer tells me that Riley, his Boston, gets the Dremel treatment once a week to grind down his nails slick and easy.
My guess is that Riley probably gets some red toenail polish every now and then, too.
Oh, boy. Flossie in New Holstein, it's your turn. Hi, Flossie.
Hi. I'm calling about my little rat terrier who has what has been diagnosed with, I guess, skin allergies. It's been an ongoing thing. She's almost 2 years old and developed skin allergies last spring and summer. And the vet felt that they could actually go away, but was put onto a course of Atopica, 25 milligrams.
Okay.
And we actually adopted her last fall. She belonged to some friends of ours. And so when I received her, she was on this daily dose of Atopica, and she was doing okay. Her skin was still fairly red, but she wasn't itching as much when she was getting the daily dose. Over Christmas, she got really bad, lost hair, very, you know, stinky smelling, was itching a lot, had a lot of skin thickening around her neck. And so the vet put her on almost a month's course of antibiotics and antifungal.
Mm-hmm.
And she cleared up really, 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 really nicely.
Great.
Almost to, you know, completely normal skin. And then she went off of that antibiotics and the antifungal, but was still taking the daily dose of Atopica, but the vet had said to put her on every other day. As soon as I did that, her skin got bad again, and so now she's back on every day. And really, you know, she's okay, but she still is
itchy.
Fairly smelly, itchy, greasy skin.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering if, since it was, you know, an all-year-round thing, if it could possibly be something to do with her food. They're not really willing to put her on a steroid at this point because she's so young, but...
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions.
Yeah, I would. I guess going again with my theme of the day, I would go to a dermatologist and have her skin tested. She is young enough. It's pretty unusual. I mean, not unheard of for dogs who are so young to wind up with, you know, to already start showing clinical signs of allergies. But if you can afford it and you can go get her skin tested, she could be a dog that would benefit from immune therapy.
Okay.
So basically, it's allergy shots, just the same as what we would get. And they'll start out by skin testing her to figure out, you know, what she's allergic to the most. And then especially because if she's getting really bad around Christmas, most dogs get really bad, you know, when humans get really bad,
right,
which
yeah.
is around now.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the time they'll want to do the skin testing in the fall where things have been really bad for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then that'll help them figure out, you know, what to suggest for the immune therapy, but that would be the route I would go with a dog like her. The reason that she's clearing up is what happens with allergies, especially, you know, where you're seeing clinical signs on the skin, is that the skin gets inflamed.
Mm-hmm.
And when the skin gets inflamed or when the dog starts scratching and licking at it, it just is like this perfect breeding ground for yeast and bacteria.
Okay.
And that's why they get greasy and they get smelly. And
yeah.
It's why, you know, that's then they get that inflammation makes it such a great breeding ground. And so then if you treat with antibiotics and antifungals, you get rid of all those kind of secondary invaders.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time you make the dog feel so much better.
Yeah.
The problem is that then those things become really chronic. And so you stop with the antibiotics, you stop with the antifungals, and then just a little bit after that, it all comes back again because the inflammation is still there.
Exactly, yeah.
So I would take her and see a dermatologist and do some allergy testing on her and see if immune therapy might help.
And do you think that that would be... in addition to staying on the Atopica, or do you think it could be something that would, you know...
Depending on how bad she is, they may want you to take her off of it for a little while they do the testing. But it sounds like if she is still symptomatic even on it, then they may be able to do the testing and everything while she's still on it.
Okay, well, thank
you. Or they may even just recommend that you use more of it if she's doing well while she's on it. But the immune therapy, a lot of the time, even though it takes a while and it doesn't work in every dog, for the dogs that it does work in, it's really worthwhile.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Sandy, somebody wanted the early warning signs that their dog may be ingesting, or maybe cat, but dog, I think, may be ingesting bad foods. And, of course, there's been a lot of publicity about this. In fact, I think the Senate just passed some legislation last Wednesday on a 94-0 vote, which has got to be the rarest of all, to safeguard the human and animal food supply. It's an amendment to an FDA bill.
Right. I think that the important thing to remember, first of all, is I was looking on the AVMA, which is the American Veterinary Medical Association website, about this. And one thing that they really wanted to make clear is that only about, even though we're hearing so much about this, it's only about 1% of the food that's commercially available that's actually been recalled. So that's actually a pretty small amount. It doesn't seem like a small amount if it's your pet that's affected,
right.
Of course. It
sure.
doesn't matter what the statistics are. And so the thing to be aware of is that what is happening, and it's been happening primarily in cats, it seems like small dogs are affected more than large dogs, and they're not sure if that is because small dogs are more likely to be fed the types of food that contain the toxin, or whether it's just because small dogs are more affected by the toxin. We're not sure of that. But what's happening is that the cats and dogs are experiencing acute kidney failure. And so what we see with acute kidney failure is lethargy, vomiting, inappetence. The animal's going to look like it really doesn't feel well. You may see increased urination, increased drinking, and it kind of goes in that direction because the animals get dehydrated because their kidneys aren't working properly, and so they need to drink more water to keep up with that dehydration. If you're seeing anything, any signs like that, I mean, even mild ones, those are indications that your animal needs to be seen by a veterinarian. And it's really important when you're seeing signs of illness like that to you know, make the step and go in and see the vet. And if there's nothing wrong, that's great. There's nothing wrong. But if there is something wrong, especially with renal failure, especially acute renal failure, if acute renal failure is caught as it's occurring, it's pretty it can be very treatable, and many of the animals, you know, can be treated here. So that's, you know, it is important to respond and take your animal in for treatment. It's also really important to keep abreast because there are new foods going on the recall list, you know, pretty much constantly, it seems like. The AVMA has a great website up right now that I, in looking through things last night, it looked like the easiest to find and most comprehensive list of all the recall foods. The ASPCA and HSUS, which is Humane Society of the United States, also have lists where you can go. And so make sure that you go and you look and you see which foods have been recalled. In general, most of the foods that are being recalled are canned foods or pouch foods, but there actually are some dry foods on the list as well as some treats that are on the list too. Be aware that, you know, one of the things that the new legislation is covering is that the FDA can't mandate any company to recall their food. So just because it wasn't recalled doesn't mean, you know, that it's totally in the clear, that all the pet food companies that are recalling their products are recalling voluntarily based on some evidence for things that may have been found in ingredients that may be in those foods.
Good points all. So go to those websites for more information. And as you said, the Humane Society of the U.S. has a line, and the veterinary, what's the other
the
one?
The American Veterinary Medical Association has one, and also the ASPCA.
Okay.
The ASPCA has really, for a long time, been kind of the leader in toxins for animals, the leader in sort of giving the public information about toxins for animals and potential toxic exposures. And so that's, it's always, the ASPCA has always been a leader in that.
Well, let's go back to the phones and to Sarah in Green Bay. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Good. I have a question. I have a six-month-old Yorkshire Terrier.
Cute.
And we just, oh, she's a baby. And we just got her fixed. And she ended up with a bladder infection. She was holding it, I think, from the pain, just being uncomfortable.
Okay.
We've got that pretty much resolved. But now our potty training has gone, like, back to square one. And I don't know if she's just confused or if the different, if the bladder infection, you know, kind of made her feel funny about it, and I don't want to scold her because I've done all positive reinforcements up to this point. She was doing, you know, rather well. Is that normal? Should I just keep working with her the same way I was and just be consistent with it?
I would, yeah. I would actually go back to square one and start all over again. And make sure that, you know, you're watching her every minute. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about when we talk about potty training and whenever things happen and things go wrong, that, you know, if I went to a public bathroom and I tried to go to the bathroom and something really bad happened while I was in there, I wouldn't go there again. I would go somewhere different the next time. And, you know, and I think that that's one of the things that happens with cats and with dogs, you know, that have infections or things that cause pain on urination is they don't understand that they had a bladder infection and inflammation in their urethra, and that was what caused the pain when they urinated. They just remember, I went over there and I tried to pee and it felt terrible. I'm not going to go there anymore. I'm going to go try to do this someplace else. And so you have to really go back to the beginning and try to reinforce that in a positive way for her, what where you do want her to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I just worried about her. I didn't want her to be freaked out about it, and I can tell she knows.
And that's why scolding really doesn't work very well. You know, really hard. You know, it does, you know, it's the way people did this for a long time, but it really isn't the best way of trying to potty train animals at all.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Jenny and Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, my cat has long hair, and it is so matted underneath that I don't know what to do with my poor kitty. He would be so pretty if his hair wasn't matted. You can't see it now, but boy, when you feel it, you know, petting me.
Yeah.
And I wonder what I can do to get rid of those mats.
So what he needs, we call the lion cut. And we should get our groomers back on the phone here again. And probably what he's going to need is to have all of that matting clipped off. And they'll need to clip it off from underneath the mat. So in between the skin and under the mat. And it's can be a pretty tough thing to do, and it can be pretty traumatic for the cat. So a lot of the time we'll recommend that it gets done with sedation or even with anesthesia. We see that fairly commonly with animals coming into animal shelters, and that's usually what we'll do. They look very cute afterwards. You usually leave them all their handsome long face around their head, and you clip them down to, you know, as short as you need to get all the matting off their whole body. It's important to do because it's hard for us to imagine because we don't have hair all over our body. But if you try to imagine what the matting feels like on their body when they try to move, it's like their hair is getting pulled every time they try to move their body or try to move their skin. And so it's really important to kind of get a fresh start with that. And then you'll be surprised how beautiful his hair will grow in from that lion cut. And then you just have to kind of keep it up as the hair grows in. So it may be something that you want to either take him to the veterinarian for or take him to the groomer for. Yeah. Because the other thing is, if you don't use a good clippers and you don't have someone who's pretty skilled to get that big mat off, you really run the risk of cutting their skin because the mat usually winds up so close to the skin that it's really difficult to do. So don't try to take a scissors or something else to it, because often it's really hard to tell the difference between the skin and the mat itself. And so you have to be pretty careful to get those off.
Good luck.
Would you recommend some kind of trauma of going in a car to give him before I took him in then?
Oh, no. I would just recommend he just goes on in, and then they'll help you. They'll help take care of him, you know, for a while he's getting taken care of.
Yeah.
And I would probably take him to a veterinarian. That would be my...
And you're going to be happier, and he's going to be
happier. He's going to be so much more comfortable.
A lot happier. So it's a little expense now, but for long-term happiness.
Yeah.
That's the recommendation, Jenny. Thank you
very
much. Good luck. Thank you. And Sandy, thank you.
Thank you. This was fun, as always.
And we'll have you back soon. We'll do this again.
Okay.
Dr. Sandy Newberry of Madison is a National Shelter Medicine Extension Veterinarian with the Corret Shelter Medicine Program at the Center for Companion Animal Health, the University of California, Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Always fun to have her with us, and she will be back again to be with us. And just, excuse me, just to let you know, coming up tomorrow at 11, we have The Singing Life of Insects. Lang Elliott and Will Hirschberger put something together. It's going to be a lot of fun. I hope you'll join us then, and I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.